The headlines Palestinian media say Israeli forces have arrested several family members of six Palestinian inmates who managed to escape an Israeli jail on Monday. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip celebrate the escape of the inmates from Israel's Gilboa prison. And a powerful earthquake hit southwestern Mexico near the beach resort of Acapulco, leaving at least one person dead. Our top story for this half-hour, Palestinian media say Israeli forces have arrested family members of the Palestinian inmates who escaped the regime's Gilboa prison earlier this week. Reports say Israeli forces stormed the houses of the six prisoners as cellmates tunneled out of one of Israel's highest security prisons on Monday. The move was the first such jailbreak in decades in Gilboa prison's history. Israel launched a massive manhunt to arrest the six. Afterward, the regime set up roadblocks and deployed surveillance vehicles to aid its search. Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah called the breakout a grave failure for Israeli security agencies. Palestinian groups also hailed the incident as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime. Our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, says Israeli troops have used threats and force against the relatives of the escaped Palestinian prisoners to get information about their whereabouts.
Until the moment, Israeli forces are still carrying out the manhunt in search of those Palestinian prisoners, those six heroes, according to the Palestinians, who succeeded to escape from Gilboa prison, north the lands occupied in 1948. This morning, Israeli forces raided Jenin in northern the occupied West Bank. They raided the town of Yabad and Arabi, arrested a number of the relatives of those six, arrested the father of Yaqub Fiad, as well as brother of Mahmoud Arda, and Qasim Arda, the brother of Muhammad Arda. And several hours later, they released the father of Fiad. However, they threatened him in case he knew anything about his son and he didn't inform the Israeli authorities or the Israeli military, then they will again storm the town, and they will not only arrest him, however, they will arrest all his family members, and said in case his son did not surrender to the Israeli forces, then the Israeli soldiers would be killing him at the end of the day.
Palestinian groups in the Gaza Strip have hailed six prisoners who managed to escape from an Israeli jail in northeast of Al-Quds on Monday. Four Palestinians. The prison break is considered as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime and its military. Ruba Shabbat has more from Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have celebrated the escape of six Palestinian inmates from Israeli maximum security Jilboa prison in north of the occupied territories through a tunnel dug in the floor. Palestinians hailed the heroic operation and handed out candies to celebrate what they call a heroic move. Palestinian factions consider the escape as a slap in the face of the Israeli regime.
This operation is a great victory for our Palestinian prisoners, the resistance, and our Palestinian people. What happened in Gilboa prison is unique. Our inmates grabbed their freedom by themselves, leaving the Israeli security defeated and confused. We are celebrating this victory as we call on all Palestinians to provide safety for those inmates.
Prisoners' groups said four of the inmates were serving life sentences. Another man was held under a special detention order, and the sixth was awaiting a verdict. Five of them belong to the Islamic Jihad movement, and one is a former commander in Fatah Party.
This escape has damaged the image of the Israeli regime before the world. It is such a great victory for Palestinians. We warn the Israeli regime against doing any action that puts the lives of those heroes at risk.
Palestinian resistance movements emphasized that the struggle for freedom with Israeli occupation persists both behind bars and outside.
This is the biggest prison break in the history of the Palestinian cause, and it's going to be a remarkable incident in history. As Palestinian resistance, we hail these inmates' efforts of grabbing back their freedom and breaking the Israeli chains. We warn Israel not to hurt those prisoners, or else this will cost the Israeli regime a lot.
Palestinians have praised the heroic escape of the Palestinian inmates, describing it a blow to the Israeli regime and its security. They also stressed that the resistance is the only way to defend their rights and liberate their lands. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The Taliban have announced key ministers of a caretaker government in Afghanistan 3 weeks after taking over the country, including the capital, Kabul. In a press conference, Zabihullah Mujahid said Hassan Akhund has been appointed acting prime minister, while Taliban co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar will be the acting deputy premier. He said Sarojuddin Haqqani has been appointed acting interior minister. The spokesman added Amir Khan Muttaqi has been named acting foreign minister. Mullah Yaqub will serve as acting defense minister in the new government. Mujahid said other ministers of the caretaker government will be announced in due course. Several of the appointees are in UN and US sanctions lists. Political commentator Brian Downing says the Taliban never expected to take over Kabul, adding the group has a hard time to transform into a centralized government.
I don't think the Taliban expected to take Kabul this quickly. I think even the Taliban people have admitted, those in Kabul say, that they really wanted some sort of government in Kabul to negotiate with, to keep foreign aid coming in, and to negotiate some sort of interim government, which they would dominate, of course, but they really weren't prepared for this. Now what they have to do is they have to go from a decentralized military movement. You know, they had provincial commanders and district commanders, and they had this council that had all sorts of factions. Now they have to become a centralized government over a population that is very poor. They're not very welcome of Pashtun rule. They never really supported the Taliban. They just found it somewhat less objectionable than the Karzai and the Ghani governments.
The Taliban say their newly appointed government in Afghanistan will uphold, quote, Sharia law in all matters of governance and life. In his first message since the group rose to power, Taliban leader Hibatullah Akhundzadeh said the new government will start functioning at the earliest. He said the group is committed to all international laws, treaties, and commitments which are not in conflict with Islamic law. Akhundzadeh pledged that the new leadership would ensure lasting peace, prosperity, and development in the country. He also called on Afghans not to leave the country. The Taliban say they've taken full control of Panjshir province, where the group is fighting against the forces of the National Resistance Front led by Ahmad Massoud. However, Massoud has dismissed the announcement by the Taliban, saying his forces still hold strategic areas of Panjshir Valley. Damien Alimi has a report.
The Taliban spokesman has declared the collapse of Panjshir Valley in the north of Kabul. Zabihullah Mujahid says the war is over in Afghanistan and that there is no anti-Taliban resistance in the country, except by Daesh.
The war is ended all over Afghanistan after successfully capturing Panjshir province as the last stronghold for the ousted enemy. The Islamic Emirate forces have active presence in the valley.
However, the leader of National Resistance Front says he is in Panjshir and that his forces are deployed across the strategic areas of the valley. According to Massoud, The resistance will push ahead with its fight on the Taliban until victory is achieved. In an audio message, Masood called on all Afghans to come together and stand against the Taliban.
I call on all my countrymen inside and abroad to launch a national uprising to defend our dignity, independence, and freedom. I also call on the international community to be aware that the Taliban has never changed.
The leader of National Resistance Front also slammed the Taliban for what he called defying the demand of a top delegation of religious scholars to engage in talks to resolve the conflict in Panjshir. He also accused Pakistan of directly invading Afghanistan, saying the Pakistani military used drones to bomb Panjshir to help the Taliban. Ahmed Massoud's claim on the Pakistani military interference in Panjshir has complicated the situation. On Monday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman was asked about the reports of Pakistani airstrikes. The spokesman said Iran condemns all foreign interference in Afghanistan without specifying any country. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A powerful earthquake has struck southwestern Mexico, leaving at least one person dead so far. The magnitude 7 quake caused rock falls and damaging buildings that also did damage to Acapulco. The tremor caused widespread power outages in several states. The Mexican State Power Utility said the quake affected some 1.6 million users across the country. The Mexican National Seismological Service said the epicenter was 14 kilometers southeast of the beach resort of Acapulco. A massive earthquake struck the Mexican capital in 1985, killing thousands of people. In the United States, the number of deaths from the novel coronavirus has surpassed the grim milestone of 650,000. The figure is based on data from the Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. has recorded more than 40.2 million COVID-19 cases. Since the beginning of the pandemic, the country is the worst hit by the pandemic in terms of both infections and fatalities. Elsewhere in the Americas, Mexico logged nearly 1,100 new deaths, raising its overall death toll close to 265,000. The country also registered nearly 16,000 new cases. The World Health Organization has criticized wealthy nations for hoarding COVID-19 vaccines and treatments.
The developed world and the industrialized world just doesn't seem to get it. It really doesn't. It talks, the rhetoric is fine, it's all about sharing, it's all about fairness, but in reality, when push comes to shove and these products are available, they are hoarded in countries and they are not shared.
The criticism came at a Q&A session attended by the WHO's top epidemiologists. They describe hoarding as an immoral and unfair practice that's prolonging the pandemic. The UN Health Agency has set a target for countries to vaccinate at least 10% of their population by the end of this month. It has called on wealthier nations to halt booster vaccine shots to help poorer countries meet the target. According to the UN, nearly 60% of the population in the European Union has been fully inoculated. In contrast, Africa has only vaccinated 3% of its population. Well, NATO has accused Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran of breaking international rules with respect to arms control. Critics, however, have pointed out to the 30-nation alliance hypocrisy given its conduct in nations such as Afghanistan. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
NATO has just concluded its 17th annual arms control conference with harsh criticism directed towards authorities in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang, and Tehran. NATO, led by the United States, continues to spend billions on military hardware, but clearly does not like it when nations outside the alliance develop their own defense capabilities.
There are also other players fielding nuclear weapons and advanced missile systems. North Korea and Iran, for example. are blatantly ignoring or breaking the global rules.
Iran has always stressed its nuclear program is purely peaceful. In fact, Tehran did all in its power to reassure the international community by signing up to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in 2015. It was the United States under Donald Trump that illegally withdrew from that nuclear accord. Stoltenberg failed to mention this once during his speech. In any case, experts say NATO is not in a position to point the finger. There are significant divisions within the 30-nation alliance. Its credibility is currently at rock bottom, critics argue, following its 20-year-long mission in Afghanistan.
The European member states of NATO will need to come up with real arguments to demonstrate that NATO makes values. You need to demonstrate the return on investment.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, concluded his address to the Arms Control Conference with these words.
You can count on NATO's commitment to security and stability.
That statement will likely cut to the bone for any Afghan citizen able to hear it. Anti-war campaigners say the destruction NATO countries brought to Afghanistan during the past two decades cannot be put into words. And now those Afghan civilians who somehow managed to survive have no idea what the future holds. Jerome Hughes at NATO headquarters, Brussels.
A fire at an overcrowded jail on the outskirts of the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, has killed 41 inmates and injured dozens more. The blaze took place during the early hours of Wednesday when the inmates were asleep in Tangerang Penitentiary in Banten province. Firefighters have managed to extinguish the blaze and evacuate the victims. An investigation is underway to find the cause of the incident. According to official data, the prison housed over 2,000 inmates. That's three times more than its capacity. Indonesian prisons are notorious for overcrowding. They contain nearly 270,000 inmates. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Recent spells of unusually cold winter weather in the United States and other parts of the Northern Hemisphere could be a paradoxical consequence of the climate warming in the Arctic, according to a study based on decades of atmospheric observations. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Quirin Schiermeier. Writer. This article is published under the heading Freak Winters Linked to Arctic Warming. Stay tuned for more. recent spells of unusually cold winter weather in the United States and other parts of Northern Hemisphere could be a paradoxical consequence of the climate warming in the Arctic, according to a study based on decades of atmospheric observations. However, it is still unclear whether this represents a long-term trend that will persist as the world heats up. The Arctic rate of warming is twice that for Earth as a whole, and some climate researchers have long suspected that this rapid Arctic warming can trigger anomalies in the winds around the North Pole, with consequences for weather thousands of kilometers further south. Conventional wisdom is that while global warming means more heat waves, it will definitely lead to less cold spells and snowfall, says Judah Cohen, a climate scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge and lead author of the study. But that's not quite true. There are mechanisms by which climate change can contribute to more severe winter weather too. One dominant feature of the winter atmosphere above the Arctic is the polar vortex, a fast-flowing band of high-altitude winds. The vortex normally isolates the atmosphere over the Arctic from warmer air closer to the equator. But when the polar vortex stretches and undulates, as it sometimes does, chilly air can leak out to latitudes that would otherwise rarely experience cold snaps. Such extreme weather can prove fatal in regions unprepared for frosty conditions. In February, at least 111 people died in Texas when cold Arctic air hit the state and parts of northern Mexico. In their study published recently in Science, Cohen and his colleagues compared 40 years of satellite observations of atmospheric conditions over the Arctic with experiments based on computational climate models. The models probed how a decline in Arctic sea ice and snow cover would affect airstreams in the region. Since ice and snow reflect a large fraction of incoming sunlight back into space, whereas the darker ocean and land surface absorb more radiation, this decline is known to drive Arctic warming. The researchers found that episodes of polar vortex stretching have markedly increased in the past few decades, and that their models reproduced this behavior well when they included the effects of Arctic warming. This is an insightful new analysis, says Dim Como, a climate scientist at the Free University Amsterdam in the Netherlands, who was not involved in the study. Its strength is that they have very carefully looked at a specific pattern of the polar vortex that is important for cold spells in particular places and backed up their observational analysis with climate modeling experiments. But the idea that Arctic warming might be responsible for cold spells in mid-latitude regions is still hotly debated among climate scientists. At first glance, it might seem obvious that winters will generally tend to get milder in a warming world, but climate models that are commonly used to study complex links between the different components of the climate system diverge on the issue of how strongly Arctic warming might influence mid-latitude winters, and state-of-the-art models do not accurately replicate observed trends in the behavior of the polar vortex. It remains to be seen whether the models are missing something or whether the observations of polar vortex stretching merely reflect natural climate variability, says Daniel Amati, a climate modeler at the Max Planck Institute of Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany, who was not involved in the study. The new analysis does not settle these questions, Matthew says, although changes in the sea ice and snow cover do seem to have a role in wind anomalies high up above the Arctic. Other factors such as decadal variability in sea surface temperatures could also drive wintertime anomalies in the Arctic atmosphere that can lead to unexpectedly cold weather elsewhere. To complicate matters further, there are still significant uncertainties about how Earth's climate as a whole responds to snow and sea ice changes. For now, it remains unclear whether the recent examples of extreme winter cold are precedents for future weather. Climate change isn't linear, Matthew says. What happens in one decade may not apply in the next one.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Once again, Tel Aviv has spoken of expediting preparations to take military action against Iran. The Army Chief says an increase in the military budget has been earmarked to that end. And this is not the first time that Israel is threatening Iran. Defense Minister Benny Gantz also said last month that we are at a point where we need to take military action against Iran. The main objective, he said, is minimizing Iranian presence in the Middle East region with an emphasis on Syria. Now, how serious are these threats? And why is Tel Aviv repeating its belligerent rhetoric against Tehran? To begin with, let's go to Mona Kandil in Ramallah and let's see what she has regarding the media reaction and all these Israeli threats that are being repeated regarding Iran again and again. Mona, over to you.
Well, that's right. First, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said that issued the threats against Iran, saying that Israel may have to take military action against Iran. And following a series of threats from Israeli high-level officials over Iran's program, now here comes new statements and new threats and warnings from Israel's chief of chief general of staff, Aviv Kohavi, saying that preparations for possible action against Iran are being intensified and that the Israeli military plans dealing with Iran's nuclear program have been greatly accelerated. And as you have mentioned, he's saying that the main objective is to minimize Iran's role in the Middle East, saying that they will not allow any role for Iran in the Middle East, mainly, namely Syria. And he said this would also be in a way or another against Hamas movement and Hezbollah as well.
Okay, thanks for that, Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Joining me in tonight's edition of The Spotlight today are... From the Answer Coalition, we'll have Richard Baker, who's joining us out of San Francisco. Political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell from Malloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now let's go to Richard. Richard, is this hot air or military action against Iran is in the offing?
Well, there's always the element of psychological warfare that Israel carries out in hostility toward other countries in the region. I think that there is a danger of stepped-up military action. There's really military action going on. We can see by the bombings that have taken place inside Iran, the assassination of Iranian scientists and other figures, the step up of military buildup by the United States as well as Israel around Iran. So there is a very real danger of this, and of course Israel has been opposed to the JCPOA toward any kind of an agreement with Iran, because what it really wants is a U.S.-backed and a U.S.-Israeli war against that country to reduce its influence and to devastate the country, because Israel seeks to be the lone military power in the region.
Now, let me ask Brian this. Brian, on what basis is Tel Aviv accusing Tehran of destabilizing the region by pursuing its nuclear program? Evidence like the funny cartoon that the former Israeli prime minister showed the United Nations a few years ago, or what?
Yeah, well, it's to talk about destabilizing the whole, what they call the deliberate ambiguity about Israel's nuclear weapons program, which of course everybody knows is there, but it's not supposed to be acknowledged, is destabilizing not only to the region but for the whole planet, the whole world, where it is undermining every effort at nuclear disarmament, and it's not only between Israel and Iran, but between, you know, even with the U.S. and Korea and the U.S. and Russia, that it affects the whole thing, and it raises great questions. It's very, very destabilizing, but I don't think stabilizing the region is what either Israel nor the United States is after.
Okay, now, Brian, there are some observers who argue that Israel keeps threatening Iran over concerns regarding the now-suspended Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal. Now, does this analysis hold water, in your opinion?
No.
Richard?
No, because I think it's...
Sorry, Brian, I put that question to Richard. Richard's on the phone. Richard,
okay,
go ahead.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I thought you were directing that to Brian. Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah, I just said that there are some observers who argue that the concern, the part of Tel Aviv, is that Iran is pursuing this nuclear program and that the Vienna talks on reviving the nuclear program have been suspended for now. And they're saying that maybe this is because of that Israel is concerned. And does this analysis hold water?
I think that you can see that the Biden foreign policy team, Blinken, and the rest of them are really the neocons. This is the neocons back in power. The fact that Biden said in the run-up to the election that the U.S. would re-enter the agreement, but since then has made additional demands on Iran, which go beyond the scope of what was agreed to when the JCPOA was established, that this is a very hostile government, the U.S. government toward Iran, and to much of the world, as a matter of fact. But I think that, we have to look at the real history of the region, and it's not Iran that's been destabilizing the region. It's Iran that played a key role in the defeat of ISIS in Iran and Syria. And it's Israel which has attacked its neighbors over and over again. It's made war against Egypt. It's made war against Syria, Jordan, Lebanon. It occupies all of Palestine. It pays no attention to international demands to withdraw from territories that were occupied in the 1967 war and has, in effect, annexed much of the West Bank and Golan Heights and East Jerusalem, and put Gaza into the condition of an open-air, giant open-air prison. So I say all this because it's really, the reality is turned upside down for people in the United States as far as the corporate mass media goes.
Okay. Now, Brian, there are some other analysts who argue that Israel's attempt to up the ante against Iran is merely a hollow show of power, and that concerns over the U.S.'s dwindling presence in the West Asia region. Let's have your comments on that.
Well, that may be true to some extent, but it's still very, very dangerous. There's no such thing as just blowing hot air in a situation like this. Events can get out of our hands, and it's the world is in a very, very dangerous place. We're in an existential crisis. The organized humanity on this planet. So it's if this is just a game, it's a very, very dangerous and irresponsible one.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, how dangerous a game could it be? Could it lead to a war?
Of course it could. Of course it could. And I think that we have to be recognize that as much as we, as most people on the planet, really do want peace, they're very powerful people who don't. Back in January, when the United States was talking about, when President Biden was talking about cutting off the sales of certain missiles to Saudi Arabia over the war in Yemen, CEO of the Raytheon Corporation, his name's Greg Hayes, he spoke out to the investors of Raytheon, and he said, look, peace is not going to break out in the Middle East anytime soon. I think that it remains an area where we will continue to see solid growth.
Right.
We're just seeing in Afghanistan while the president is said we're not going to have troops in Afghanistan anymore, and for now we don't have them. But the over-the-horizon attacks, the drones and the bombers, will continue. And we have evidence that the United States is absolutely aware, from the CIA leaked cables to public interviews by generals, that this is destabilizing and that it is making more enemies than we can we can kill. General McChrystal had said, when he was still the head of NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan, spoke about the drone attacks, and he said, for every person we kill, every innocent person we kill, the United States gets 10 new enemies. Well, in one day last week, the United States garnered at least 130 new enemies through a drone strike on Kabul. And but see, that's not considered, General McChrystal and the CIA don't consider this a reason not to have these attacks, because war sounds horrible, but if you have a lot of money in Raytheon, and Raytheon just as one corporation, Lloyd Austin, former general, also former board member of Raytheon, is now the Secretary of Defense. So these people are very, very powerful. And war breaking out to some of these people is their greatest fear. Not what could happen with the war going out of control, but the very idea that somehow some kind of stability and some kind of peace, and that the people of the countries of the region will no longer be markets for their product, mm-hmm. is a great fear, and they're going to do what they can to keep peace from breaking out.
Right. Now, Richard, the U.S. defense chief said in Qatar on Tuesday that Iranian military activity in the Middle East continues to ramp up tensions. He was actually echoing Tel Aviv's anti-Iran rhetoric, as you see. Whose activities are causing tension in this part of the world, Tehran's or Washington's?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think the answer is very clear, that it is indeed Washington. It's not. We don't have a situation where Iranian warships are deployed off the coast of Palestine, Israel. They're not off New York Harbor, but they are very close to, and these are nuclear-armed ships, submarines, and warships are right off the coast of Iran and throughout the region. And that's the main danger to the region. That's the big problem that the region faces, is the U.S. insistence on being the dominating power in it with Israel as the junior partner. You would think that given the withdrawal, and I think this goes along with what your other guests are saying, you would think with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which has been immensely expensive, estimated $2.3 trillion so far spent, and going and it will eventually cost $6 trillion, you would think, at least withdrawing from Afghanistan, the military budget would go down a little. But instead, it's going up. The House Armed Services Committee and Senate just added $24.5 billion to a military budget, which publicly is said to be $738 billion already, but is even greater. And what's the purpose of this budget? What is the purpose of this enormous budget that's three times the size of the next largest military budget in the world, that's China? Mm. But probably in reality, if we're honest about the military budget, it's larger than all the other military budgets put together. That's not for defense. That's not to protect democracy. When let's talk about countries like Saudi Arabia, which has never had an election, but it's a close U.S. ally. It's for global domination. That's what's going on. And so as the U.S. policies are to eliminate any competition. It's not the people of the United States that are in competition with people of other countries. It's the rulers of the United States who want to dominate, and also those who hold these immense holdings like Raytheon, the immense stock holdings and so forth. For them, war is good. For us, for the people, war is terrible.
Right. Now, Brian, Washington says it's committed to working together with the Tel Aviv regime to enhance regional security and defenses against destabilizing actions. Can you name one single instance where the U.S. restored security to this region?
No. That's a simple answer. Quite to the contrary. Everything has been destabilizing, and as the other guest said, the idea that we have nuclear warships so close to Iran, as I say, destabilizing does not meet the is not strong enough to say about what the potential of things getting out of hand, and it is, it is being pushed where we're supposedly getting out of Afghanistan, but so that we can focus on our other threats, as Mr. Biden said, with China, Russia, and Iran. And if the United States could not defeat the Taliban after 20 years, we're going to be now ramping up tensions with admitting we're doing this. We're going to be challenging China and Russia and also Iran, and it's it does not look good for anyone. And I have to say about this, the spending, it does not. We are the United States spending more than any other country, more than maybe all of them combined on our so-called defense, is making us less safe. We are one of the countries that has the developed, so-called developed countries that has the least efficient healthcare system. Our infrastructure is falling apart. We cannot feed ourselves. We can't take care of our children. We cannot meet the disasters of the climate emergencies going on all over this country. And it's because all of this money, all of our resources, all our treasure is, all our research is all going into more weapons, and it's only enriching the very, very smallest number of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Richard, let me ask you this question. You know, as you definitely have heard, Israeli officials are expressing concerns over what they're calling Iran's nuclear ambitions. Multiple IAEA reports endorse Iran's full compliance with a nuclear deal before the U.S. abandoned it. Tehran then started scale backing, and now it's pledged to go back to full compliance, provided the U.S. returns to the agreement and lifts its sanctions. So this is in no way any good excuse, is it?
No, it's not. And, I think we can see that the Biden administration is trying to take advantage of what the Trump administration set in motion, which is this extreme tightening of sanctions and blocking trade, Iran's trade, with other countries in the world in order to ratchet up the suffering inside Iran in the hopes that it would bring about political change. Or, if not, and I think really they don't believe that will bring about the political change, will weaken Iran to such a degree that it will be willing, the government will be willing to accept new provisions in order to restore the JCPOA. That have to do with other elements of Iran's military, which is really quite outrageous. I mean, Iran's military is nothing, really, in terms of its technical, its technological development compared to the United States. But the United States wants to tell them, no, you can't have this and you can't have that, in addition to the provisions of the JCPOA that were already in existence and were quite burdensome, really, quite difficult for Iran, and there was a disagreement within Iran about whether or not to accept those. But now it's saying, the U.S. is saying, oh, not on top of those, you have to do this and this and this, and that's what stalled the talks. It's not that Iran is not showing up in Geneva or something like that. Mm-hmm. The stalling of the talks to restore the JCPOA, which was a promise of Biden that he would do that if elected president. That burden rests with the United States government.
Right. And Brian, the Israeli officials are saying that they are concerned about Iran's regional influence, especially they are emphasizing Iran's activity in the region with an emphasis on Syria. What's the deal with Syria?
Well, I don't think there's much goodwill that the United States has for Syria at all. But I think that the idea of Iran's influence is of course for good or bad. Iran is in the region; it should have influence. It needs to have influence. A peaceful Middle East will not be a peaceful Middle East unless Iran has some influence with its neighbors, and that's just a given. What we should be more concerned about is like what is the interest of the United States. Having the United States Coast Guard has ships in the Persian Gulf. We have no business having that kind of influence, and I believe that this is really part of the fear of peace breaking out. Back to Afghanistan as well. The United States does not want an Afghanistan that's at peace with its neighbors and has. It's looking out for the affairs of and the benefit of its own people and having peaceful relationships and fair trading relationships with its neighbors that include Iran and include China and include some of the republics that have very good relations with Russia, which actually is a neighbor as well, is when peace breaks out. The U.S. corporations are going to be, and our oil companies, we're going to be left high and dry. And the United States will need to, at that point, depend on peaceful relations with our neighbors, which we don't really have either. So, peace breaking out has to happen and the world has no choice.
Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Let me thank our guests on the phone from the Answer Coalition. We had Richard Becker in San Francisco and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell joined us from Malloy, Iowa. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام: إن الله سبحانه جعل الطاعة غنيمة الأكياس عند تفريط العجزة.
Imam Ali said, when the disabled falls short in performing acts of obedience to Allah, the Glorified, it is a good opportunity given by Allah for the intelligent to perform such acts. Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the things which we should all pay attention to, and of course it is considered the pillar of Islam, is the salah, is the prayer, the namaz, these obligatory prayers which a Muslim prays five times a day. These are known as one of the pillars of Islam. It is the pillar of religion, and it is also considered the mi'raj of the mu'min. So the mi'raj meaning an ascension of the believer. So this prayer, dear friends, the obligatory prayers are one of the most, if not the most important thing in Islam. This five times a day where a human being, a Muslim, takes time out to focus on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted. They take time out to be able to focus on Allah, to be able to pay attention to Allah. They take time out in order to focus their heart and their soul and their body as well towards their Creator, their loving nourisher, Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so we find that these are just the obligatory prayers. I mean, if we speak in layman's terms, this is something that we have to do anyways. We should be doing, right? But Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that he never abandoned even the recommended night prayers, right? These namaz-e-shab, as it's called in Farsi or in Urdu, these are midnight prayers, which of course are recommended. They are not wajib, they're not obligatory, but they are highly, highly recommended for a Muslim, for a believer to pray. So these recommended night prayers were never abandoned by Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, to the extent where not just in the easy and comfortable nights were they not missed by Imam Ali, but even during the most difficult and the most troublesome and the most frightening and horrible of nights, these recommended night prayers were not abandoned by Imam Ali. For example, it is said that during the Battle of Siffin, which was a very big and all-encompassing battle, the battle against Muawiyah, who had risen up against Imam Ali alayhi salam when he was the caliph of the Muslims, and he was the popularly appointed caliph of the Muslims. Muawiyah rose up and fought and rebelled against Imam Ali. And so one of these nights is called